Hi, everybody. My name is Greg Hancock, and along with my counterintuitive friend Patrick Curran, we make up Quantitude. We're a podcast dedicated to all things quantitative, ranging from the relevant to the completely irrelevant. In today's episode, we talk about Simpson's paradox, what it is, examples of where it occurs in real life, and why we might not really need to think of it as a paradox at all. Along the way, we also mention Apple Vision, The Simpsons predicting the future, sitting too close to the TV, safe levels of radiation, Paul the Octopus, Blinky, Stuff, Duck Duck Duck, Jonathan the Tortoise, baseball batting averages, bad at fractions, Cal Berkeley admissions, GDP and happiness, exercise and heart attacks, and the double super secret whatever. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
I was walking across campus yesterday, and I thought I was in a Simpsons episode.
Which one of the 864
Okay, so yes, they are accruing over time. There are whole websites dedicated to how the Simpsons predict the future.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was in one of these because I saw my first person who had these new Apple Vision headsets on and were in the quad waving their hands. They were painting a picture, or they were playing a game, or they were writing an email, or they were having some kind of seizure and I needed to give them help. It was not clear which. Maybe 10 or 15 years ago, The Simpsons had an episode where there were these new VR goggles. Everybody got them, and society was just in chaos.
This is still a new technology, sir. At the moment, it's really pornography, a roller coaster, pornography, pornography, Burger King. And pornography.
First of all, the goggles are incredibly cool, and I've been thinking, oh, do I get one or not? It's just such a weird thing. It goes against something that I was beaten with as a child, and that is don't sit too close to the TV.
When you watched 5 hours a day because your single dad thought that was okay?
I was far enough back.
As you squint at me. So, folks, we're on Zoom right now, and when he said that, he literally squinted at me, and it was not ironically. You actually squinted. So, sure, 5 hours a day for 15 years, and your vision is completely unaffected.
They were safe levels of radiation. You are so right about The Simpsons, how many things occurred. It's like that octopus that can predict the World Cup. I don't know. You know what I'm talking about?
Meet Paul the Octopus, one of the World Cup's most successful prognosticators.
What were some of the ones in The Simpsons that did that?
So if you're bored, Google this, because there are websites that are dedicated to cataloging all of the times The Simpsons predicted the future. Now, some is a blind pig finding a truffle, right? As if you do 800 episodes, occasionally you're going to get something right. But some were kind of crazy. So some of the really famous ones was they went in the future and the kids were grown up and Lisa was president and her main priority was trying to recover from the Trump presidency.
As you know, we've inherited quite a budget crunch from President Trump. How bad is it, Secretary Van Houten?
We're broke.
One that's particularly chilling is faulty voting machines.
Ooh, one of those electronic voting dealies.
One vote for McCain. Thank you.
No, I want to vote for Obama.
Two votes for McCain.
Come on, it's time for a change.
Three votes for McCain.
This machine is rigged.
Although my favorite, even above calling the Trump presidency, do you remember Blinky the Three-Eyed Fish?
All right, Three-Eyed Fish.
Of course I remember Blinky.
They were fishing in the pond next to the nuclear power plant, and somebody caught a fish that had three eyes. They named it, obviously, Blinky. And Montgomery Burns kept saying how evolutionarily advantageous it was because he could see 50% better. At some point, somebody caught a three-eyed fish next to a nuclear power plant.
Fast forward to 2017. An actual three-eyed fish was found in the waters of Argentina near a nuclear plant.
Here's something that gets me about shows like The Simpsons and South Park and Family Guy and all of that. I think they're hilarious, right? And my kids generally think that they're really, really funny. And so we can be watching those, or they will share clips of stuff with me and we'll laugh about it. But I swear, if I say any of those things in real life, just naturally, I make the same joke that occurs on The Simpsons or on Family Guy or South Park, my kids look at me like, like I have three eyes. How offensive I am, or how can I even think something like that is funny? And it's the exact same stuff that they think is funny when they see there.
But it's paradoxical, right?
Completely.
In one setting, it is uproariously funny, but in another, how can you say such a thing, you horrible person? Now drive me to school because it's raining and I don't want to wait for the school bus.
Did you pack my lunch?
With jam or whatever
raspberry jam
snowflake kids eat.
So you know what we could call this, right? This is just low-hanging fruit. The Simpsons paradox?
Oh, nice.
Huh?
The Simpsons, huh? A paradoxical, the Simpsons paradox.
Thank you very much, everybody.
It's almost like you and I prepared beforehand to talk about this. And we completely organically and just by pure happen chance set up that pivot of Simpsons paradox. Wow. What are the odds? One form of Simpsons paradox is your kids are appalled when you repeat something that Barney said in the bar in a Simpsons episode, but laugh uproariously when Barney says it himself.
Hey, you're Homer's sister-in-law, right? But I don't remember you being so beautiful. Oh, hey, is that a new kind of mace? Really painful.
But you know what? The other Simpsons paradox is installment number two of Shit You Should Know.
Wait.
Oh,
wait.
I did it again. This is a family episode.
I am offended by what you just said.
And it is paradoxical.
Yes.
Because before we started the recording, you were cursing like a pirate. This is installment number two of Stuff You Should Know. And that was a very long walk to Simpsons paradox. If you are quant curious, you should have in your back pocket, what is Simpsons paradox? And we're going to loop my brother in again because he is the microcosm of somebody who lives out in the world. And this applies to you. You have five different marketing teams. And when you look over all five of them, you conclude one thing. But in each team individually, you would conclude something else. That's Simpsons paradox.
So two reactions really quickly. One is you might be the only person in the world who uses your brother as the embodiment of normal. So I might take a little bit of issue with that.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that, you know, like the previous Stuff You Should Know episode, this is something that occurs in the wild all the time. So we're not just picking on something esoteric and saying, hey, this is really something you might be interested to know about. This is something that you encounter in the research that you're confronted with, in the claims that you read in the media. And so becoming a little bit more educated about this topic and knowing where to call bull stuff. Would we say bull stuff now? Knowing, and I'm trying to be family friendly here. Knowing where to call BS on stuff and to understand a little bit better, that is part of our goal here.
You did organically come up with something there that I really like. Stuff. It is now officially Stuff You Should Know.
Stuff You Should Know. All right.
Greg is spot on. Simpsons paradox happens all the time. And a lot like regression to the mean, we reinvent this every 10 years. And you know whose fingerprints are on the original murder weapon is Pearson in 1899.
Wow.
So taking a walk down memory lane, people claim that the term Simpsons paradox was first used by a guy named Blythe in 1972. And he was referring to a paper Simpson wrote in 1951.
Okay.
Go to Simpsons 1951, and he invoked a guy named Kendall from 1945. If you go to Kendall 1945, that dredges up Pearson in 1899 and our friend Yule, who invented the Yule log on a prior episode that we figured that out.
That's right.
Yule had some contributions in statistics, but he also invented the Yule log. If you're new to statistics, that's not true, but it should be. 1903.
Yeah.
Right. So Simpson had nothing to do with this. unlike the Hancock toxic masculinity scale that can unambiguously be attributed to you, this can go back to the turn of the prior century. Let's set up what we're talking about, and then we're going to get into some real ticket ones. This one is real, but it doesn't have direct implications unless you want a pet duck versus a duck for dinner.
Which matters to the duck, by the way.
All right, let's start out super simple. And let's say I am interested in the relation between the body mass of animals and the life expectancy of animals. So I get 50 cows, I get their average body mass, I get their average life expectancy, and that's my datum. And I get 50 dogs and 50 cats and 50 mice and 50 ducks. And I get 50 people, and I add up their weight, get the average, get their life expectancy, get the average. And what you find is a very strong positive relation. Mm-hmm. Animals with a larger body mass, on average, tend to outlive animals with a smaller body mass. Elephants live longer than cows, live longer than cats, live longer than mice. Now, notice there's an on average, because there's that idiotic tortoise that's like 180 years old, and he screws everything up.
Meet Jonathan, the oldest land animal in the world. This tortoise is 190 years old.
Yeah.
All right. But on average. And you say, okay, great. You asked a question, you gave me an answer. But I got my 50 ducks. All right. I love ducks. I don't know why. I think it's more just saying the word ducks. Everybody with me. Duck, 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 duck. It's a fun duck, 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 duck.
Okay.
And you know what? Is if I look at just the ducks, there's actually a very strong negative relation. That is, ducks with a larger body mass live less long, and ducks with a smaller body mass live longer. On average, ducks have a shorter life expectancy than cows, but within ducks, larger ducks have a shorter life expectancy than smaller ducks. That is why if you want a pet duck, you get a leaner duck. If you want a duck for dinner, you get a duck with a larger body mass.
Because it's not going to live that much longer anyway.
Picture in your mind's eye now this very simple question about what is the relation between body mass and life expectancy. Aggregating over the groups, it's strong and positive. Conditioning within groups, it's strong and negative. So what is the relation? Is it positive or is it negative? And the answer is yes.
No! So here's the paradox, right? I've got these two ways of thinking about things. If we ask the question, does having a higher body mass index mean you are going to live less long? I've got these two competing ways of thinking about things. And these kinds of things occur all the time in data, not just with ducks and animals, but with all kinds of things that we encounter in day-to-day life, in research. It's all over.
And big ticket stuff. There have been examples of things about racial differences, about sex differences, about socioeconomic differences, where conclusions have been strongly drawn at the aggregate level that do not apply to any of the individuals when you consider group membership. So give me an example. I need to refill my coffee. Entertain me.
Well, if it's entertainment that you're going for without any grand social implications, then the classic example has to do with two baseball players.
Now we're talking. It does have to do with baseball.
Baseball has marked the time. It reminds us of all that once was good.
Back in the 90s, if we were looking at two very, very popular baseball players, David Justice, who, if I remember, was the Atlanta Braves. Does that sound right?
Yep.
And then Derek Jeter. I've heard of Derek Jeter. What's that little team in New York that he played for?
Not booing Jeter, booing the Yankees.
And the Cubs beat the Yanks in New York, the first win they've ever had in this ballpark.
If I look at how each of them performed in 1995 and 1996, you can even carry it into 1997, what happens every year is that David Justice has a higher batting average in 95, he has a higher batting average in 96, he even has a higher batting average in 97. And so I am tempted to say, well, obviously, David Justice is the better baseball player. However, if we aggregate it across all of those years, who's going to be the better batter? Your intuition says, well, obviously, if Justice was the better batter in 95 and 96 and 97, it's David Justice. It's not. It's Derek Jeter. If we aggregate across all of those years, Derek Jeter actually comes out to have a higher batting average.
Don't!
And so we could ask the question, who is the better baseball player? That's the paradox.
You can think about them in terms of counts and frequencies. So people who aren't familiar with baseball, what a batting average is actually very easy to calculate. Of the number of times you go to the plate to bat, what proportion of those do you safely hit and get on base? It is a batting average, and it literally is. If you have a batting average of 0.25, it means that throughout the season, of your total plate appearances, 25% of the time you safely hit. What I like about this is it really does highlight the source of Simpson's paradox, which are these differential counts of in the numerator and in the denominator. Okay, and what I mean by that is if you look at those David Justice and Derek Jeter batting averages, when you look at plate appearances, David Justice had a higher batting average than Derek Jeter in 1995, but Jeter only had 48 plate appearances and David Justice had 411.
Right.
The following year, Derek Jeter had a lower batting average than David Justice, but Derek Jeter had 582 plate appearances versus 140 plate appearances. There's a differential in these denominators. And so when you look within year versus aggregating over year, that is the explanation for why you get these differences. But it is utterly counterintuitive, right? In 1 year, player A is better. In the next year, player A is better. In the next year, player A is better. But across the 3 years, player B is better.
And that's because when we think about it intuitively, we're not weighting those things, right? We're taking this fraction and this fraction and this fraction and thinking, well, okay, well, the overall, the average fraction has to conform. But when we compute something in the margin, which is really what we're doing, right? We're taking information that's in the cells of some grid and then we're aggregating it off to the margin. I think the problem is we're bad at fractions, right? And I mean, just that's what it is. Simpson's paradox, you're bad at fractions. Thank you very much, everybody. We have this belief that when you have a numerator and a denominator in one fraction and a numerator and denominator in another fraction, and then we add those together, that somehow the sum of numerators and the sum of denominators must conform to what's going on in the individual fractions. And that's just not so, right? But that's where we feel that discomfort. If there had been exactly the same number of plate appearances, right? Same number of at-bats for Jeter and for Justice, then our intuitions would conform with what we would actually observe. But that's not the case at all. And that's why we get a difference in the sum of the numerators relative to the sum of denominators in the aggregate than we do in the individual cases. And that's kind of what Simpson's paradox boils down to.
Think about it, the extreme of what Greg is saying. Let's say a player had 2 plate appearances in a season and safely hit in one of those. They would be the greatest baseball player who have ever played the game because they would have a batting average of 500 because it was 1/2. Putting some meat on the bones of what Greg just said, should we treat that 0.5 as equivalent estimate of the 0.3 for somebody who had 800 plate appearances? To reflect that, in the rules of Major League Baseball, every year they give what's called a batting title. Who is the best batter in the American League and who is the best batter in the National League? There is a written rule that to qualify for the batting title, you have to have a minimum of 502 plate appearances. If you have fewer than that, you can't be considered for the batting title.
I want to ask you a very practical question before we go to another example. Who then in your mind is the better batter? Is it the better batter in terms of the aggregate for this example, or is it the better batter if we slice it by year?
And this gets at the heart of Simpson's paradox. It depends which question you're asking. If you're looking for the batting title for 2023, it is within the year. Who in that season was the best batter? If you're talking about who's going to go to the Hall of Fame and your lifetime batting average, then it's the aggregate over a 20-year period.
Okay.
What is the life expectancy for ducks? What is the life expectancy across all species? It's the same as who is the batting champion in 2023 and who is the lifetime batting champion. Those are both valid things, but for the love of all that is holy, get it right. Don't confound one with the other. This is where Simpson's paradox comes out of the murk and bites you on the butt. Because let's not talk about batting average, which in everyday life nobody cares about. But let's talk about sex differences in admission to Cal Berkeley.
That is a great example of Simpson's paradox, because that is some serious stuff. It affects the decisions for individuals, that affects how we think about institutions and decision making. So walk us through that.
It is David Justice and Derek Jeter, but applied at a really important societal level kind of thing. 1973, of all the applicants who submitted for admission into Cal Berkeley, they admitted 41%. When you stratified on men, it was 44%, and on women, it was 35%. And a lawsuit was filed about sex discrimination in admission, and it's true, unambiguously, there is a sex difference in the probability that you would get admitted to Cal Berkeley. Entire papers have been written on this if you're interested. When you stratified on department, all right, so this is the equivalent of saying the overall batting average for two players versus looking at the batting average within each year. When you stratified on department in the university, the vast majority, not entirety, but the vast majority actually favored women in admissions.
No!
Why? It's what Greg said about the weighting. Those proportions are not weighted in the aggregate, and what women tended to do was apply to more competitive departments that had lower admission rates within each department. When you aggregate over them, men have the clear advantage. When you condition on department, the vast majority of the time, women have the advantage.
We have to ask ourselves, what's the right thing? In the case of the baseball example, it came down to, well, what do you mean by better? Do you mean better by season, or do you mean better by career or some particular time window? This is about bias. In that particular example, all of the admission decisions were actually made at the department level. So if you look at it in aggregate and you go, oh, Berkeley admits more men than women, we have a problem here. That might not be the right level to be looking at it, right? If we go into the departments and we go, well, wait, this department admits proportionally more of the female applicants. This one does, this one does, this one does. Then the question is, do we have a bias problem here?
When we talked about regression to the mean, we talked about that as a statistical artifact that has to happen under many circumstances. This is a paradox in that it really reflects a misspecified model. We're not taking into account these conditioning on subgroups or whatever that might be. Bias is a good word. Mm-hmm. So examples are everywhere. And again, if you teach this or you want to bring it into your workplace, because this is big ticket stuff that happens all over. Just Google Simpson's paradox examples, and there are dozens of them, real ones that you can identify. Between 1974 and 1978, the overall tax rate increased from 14.1 to 15.2, but it decreased in nearly every income category. So when you stratify income and category, tax rate went down.
Dude!
All right, imagine how the politicians handled that. One political group said, taxes have gone up, and the other group said, taxes have gone down. And they're both right because they're using a different referent. There's a great example from The Economist that came out last year that looked at economic growth in terms of GDP and happiness. And it shows that looking across countries, the higher the GDP is, the more happy people tend to be. Within countries, the majority of that relation is negative. Pick out a country, and higher income is associated with less happiness. So what is the relation between GDP and happiness? Is it positive or negative? Yes, it is. But this can also happen within an individual. So consider, on average, people who exercise are less likely to have a heart attack, but you are more likely to have a heart attack when you're exercising. Another example that is still playing out in real time, because people disagree about this, what is the relation between anxiety and alcohol use within adolescents? On average, more anxious people tend to drink more. However, when you're more anxious than you usually are, you tend to drink less than you usually do because you're not going out in a social setting where drinking takes place.
Mm.
So is there a positive relation or is there a negative relation? Yes. This stuff happens all the time.
And a lot of the time, it can be distilled down to some lurking variable, some third variable problem, or multiple such variables that we're just not explicitly taking into account. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not we should. If I told somebody something like, for kids who participate in Head Start, they tend to do worse when they get to kindergarten than kids who don't participate in Head Start. The quick interpretation of something like that is, I guess we shouldn't be putting kids into Head Start. But obviously, when you think about that, you say, well, who tends to go into Head Start? Those are kids who are from lower income, and kids who tend to not go into Head Start are kids from higher income. And you know that. And you would be very quick to say something like, well, really, to understand that relationship, we have to control for family income. Makes total sense, because income in part has a bearing on the decision to participate in Head Start. And then both of those in turn have a bearing on success later academically, as in the next year in kindergarten. We know this. And yet in the examples that we're talking about right now, we sometimes forget about that.
Oh, for stuff's sake. You're not going to invoke colliders, are you?
No, I don't know if I'm invoking colliders or double super secret backdoor, whatever the heck it would be called. I don't know. A way to think about it, and this is not a foolproof way to think about it, but a way to think about it is whether or not the confounding variable or variables that are operating are things that temporally precede what's going on. Should we condition on those? And I use the word condition on because condition on, control for, those things really are sort of getting at the same thing. But in essence, what we're doing is conditioning on that. And when we have some prior variable that we think influences the variables whose relation we're trying to understand, if that precedes it generally, then that's something we might consider slicing the data by, right? Looking at the relation that exists within each of those to be able to get a better understanding of what's going on. And there's some very, very nice writings by Pearl, whether you want to get into it very, very technically, or if you want to get into it more colloquially. He talks about Simpson's paradox. Well, frankly, he talks about it at every opportunity, but he does a nice sort of layperson job in his wonderful book with Dana McKenzie called The Book of Why. Temporality is not the only reason to decide whether or not you should condition on, because you can have more complex relationships upstream. However, if the variable or variables that you think might be the things that are altering the nature of the relation are temporal precedents, then you might think about that as being something that you condition on if you can articulate the full causal model. On the other hand, if it's something that comes downstream a little bit later, then that would be, and this is where your term of collider comes in, you wouldn't want to condition on a collider. You wouldn't want to condition on something that's downstream, because in fact, that can induce an apparent relation where really there shouldn't be one that exists. So that the unsurprising take-home message from someone like Pearl, but also the unsurprising message from people like us, you really need to have a model in place. You need to have a picture of what all the variables are that are relevant and what variables should you be controlling for to get at the relation that you're interested in. And that will help you to decide whether or not you should be looking at things in the aggregate or whether you should be looking at things condition by condition by condition.
This stuff can happen in the workplace. So in my brother's group, and he has multiple marketing teams and he's trying to understand employee performance, do you look across all of your groups in the aggregate? Do you look within group? I heard a clip the other day from Nikki Haley, and she said something like, the economy is in tatters and inflation is out of control.
Wow.
Well, that's not what Kai tells me.
Which is truth.
Inflation? Check. The labor market? Check. Consumers? Check. The politics of this economy? Not today, Dad.
ask yourself like that 1970s, are taxes going up or are taxes going down? Well, it depends. How are you conditioning or aggregating the data? Being a knowledgeable consumer of information in the media is asking yourself the usual, where did the data come from? What is the sample? What is the measure? But now we'll throw a Yule log onto the fire that Yule invented in 1903 and say, well, is this the aggregate or is this conditioned on some important subgrouping?
Right.
The thing that drives me a little nuts is, one, unlike some things that we work with that are baked in artifacts that we have to deal with, this really is more of a misspecified model. If there is an important subgroup difference and you look at the aggregate, you are not fitting the proper model to capture that relation. The other is, this is something we seem to keep rediscovering every 5 or 10 years. When I was looking over some papers in preparation for this topic, that was totally ad-libbed after you did the Simpsons paradox, so I did not read papers last night. There was a really nice paper by a guy named Wegner in 1982. This is 42 years ago that he wrote this. He says, Simpson's paradox is not a contrived pedagogical example. Because this situation occurs at the level of a purely descriptive data analysis, it can easily bewilder the statistically naive observer. Classroom discussions of descriptive statistics should include examples of anomalies such as Simpson's paradox. And I really love that because, one, he's writing that 42 years ago, that was 80 years after Pearson and Yule first wrote about it. But the second one is, this is not a contrived pedagogical example. I love that. A lot of times we build things in to make a point and we say, ah, but you probably won't encounter this in practice. You encounter this all the time. It is understandable, it's explicable, and we can weave this into our teaching to try to demystify it as people move forward in their own work.
Exactly right. So in the spirit of the, what do we say, stuff?
Stuff you should know.
Stuff you should know episodes. We want you to be armed with this kind of thinking where you are questioning the things that you read, the things that you consume, and asking yourself whether or not it makes sense to think about things in the aggregate or whether or not it makes sense to think about it in the particular conditions of interest. And we hope that we've got you thinking that way as you go back out into the world.
So when you're in a job talk and somebody presents something that looks like Simpson's paradox, you can yell from the back, bull stuff.
Nobody likes you.
Not a person. Not a person. Take care, everybody.
I like you.
Aw, that's bull stuff.
All right, take care. See ya.
Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to Quantitude on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your off-the-hook spring break road trip playlists, and please leave us a review. You can also follow us on Twitter X, we are at QuantitudePod, and check out our webpage at quantitudepod.org for searchable archives, playlists, show notes, a syllabus that organizes episodes under class topics, and other cool stuff. Finally, you can make a futile effort at damage control after completely forgetting Valentine's Day with awesome Quantitude-themed merch at redbubble.com, where all proceeds from non-bootleg authorized products go to donors choose to support low-income schools. You have been listening to Quantitude. So paradoxical, we don't even need to include the word paradox. Quantitude has been brought to you by Daily Life Stuff You Should Know. When your partner asks your opinion about two options of anything, do not say, I don't care. Say, I like them both equally well. Why don't you decide? Remember that if you give a person a fish, you feed them for a day. If you teach a person to fish, you permanently lose your leverage. Never, ever yell at your students. Instead, lean in closely and whisper. It is much more terrifying. From a legal perspective, counting to 10 only makes it premeditated. And finally, it is as bad as you think, and they are out to get you. This is most definitely not NPR.